lot of confusion about what's going on with this COVID-19. And so we're going to set out to clear some of this up, go to a doctor, a medical researcher who will help us clear this up, that's going to be answering some of the questions out there that people are having.
Stretch your mind. It's that time again to yank your brain away from stinking thinking and wash it in new ideas and thoughts. It's time for your checkup from the neck up and maybe a massive mental enema. This yank is going to give your brain a crank, has been called a genius since his patents are part of every mobile device made. Get ready for him to reach into your ears and massage that brain of yours. Your host, Jovan Hutton-Pulitzer.
So let me tell you who he is. His name is Dr. Paul Berish. He's a deeply committed medical researcher. And when I say that, think about somebody who has the gift of being able to translate research, meaning reading what's going on, and then creating applied strategy for health systems, meaning how can you strengthen the health of a population? How can you apply it to disease prevention? Well, Dr. Paul has more than 25 years of experience as a practicing physician and a physician executive in the military and in academic medical centers. Paul is a double boarded anesthesiologist with critical care physician scientist, and he's a clinical professor at Wayne State University School of Medicine. You've heard of them, Children's Hospital of Michigan. He's a lecturer and a senior advisor to the dean at the Jefferson College of Public Health. He trained at Massachusetts General Hospital, affiliated with Harvard Medical School. Now, his work has led to over $14 million in federal competitive grant funding. And he served as editor of the British Medical Journal of Safety and Quality and has published more than 300 scientific papers and 5 books. Now you know what I'm saying. We're going to go to somebody who is really in the know. So, Dr. Paul, welcome to the program.
Thanks, Hutton. Great to be here.
Thank you, sir. So let's get to it, because I really want to focus on just trying to demystify the clutter of information. It's really hard to tell what's true and not true, and because there's just so many competing sources for this information, and a lot of them are contradictory. Let's just start off. Give us a review of kind of the underlying medical conditions and what are the people that are at higher risk for COVID-19?
Sure, Hutton. So we've been with COVID now for about 4.5-5 months, and we've learned a lot. What we've learned is that the virus has a unique predilection for certain bodily cells, so-called ACE2 receptors, that are located in different parts of the body, but primarily in certain key organs like the lungs, the heart, and the gastrointestinal system. And so the key injuries of COVID have been pulmonary, they've been to the heart, they've been to the brain, and they've been to the GI system. As you can imagine, people that have conditions that put those organs at higher risk, so people, for example, that have had heart disease, or they've had asthma and obstructive lung disease, or people that have had certain mental ailments or diabetes. Those are the types of conditions that put you at risk at any age, and particularly over the age of 60. Although it's clear now, particularly in less affluent societies and in countries that are usually labeled as low-income countries, that now people as young as 30 and 40 who have those conditions, diabetes, heart disease, lung disease, or another type of immune suppressive disease, for example, people that have been on chemotherapy for cancer, or people that have arthritis. So a whole series of diseases in which either you have a natural immune suppression, or you're taking medicines in order for you to be able to be well, if you will, and work, be active, you need to take certain drugs that suppress your system. And so those are the types of people that are at high risk. And then finally, there's a group that's emerging now in the last 4 weeks And those are children, now about 500 kids in the U.S. now, who have developed a certain inflammatory-like illness. Relatively rare, but emerging now as a key concern in the U.S. in the last month.
Is this just the normal way a virus like this happens? I mean, is it changing on us? Is that why it's popping up in kids? Or is that just we're now finally recognizing that's what it is? How did this kid thing pop up really quick?
Well, so the kid thing is really interesting because the time horizon of the illness in kids is very different. So usually, Hutton, if you got exposed to somebody who was infected and you were around them for at least 30 to 45 minutes, you would usually start to exhibit some symptoms within 5 to 8 days. And then if you went on to get ill, usually be another 5 to 8 days. So about 2 to 2.5 weeks after you were exposed. It turns out in kids, their illnesses manifest only 4 to 6 weeks after they've been exposed. And that has given us insight belatedly on the fact that there's a massive attack by this virus on the body through the release of proteins. They're called cytokines, which then activate the body's own immune system to attack the body. So it's a very different type of model than what we were seeing initially, but it might give us some more insight into how to protect not just children, but also adults in understanding how the virus is able to activate, slow walk the immune system, very different than the original few months of the virus attack, which seemed to be more directed at cells directly, but not necessarily activating the immune system in the way that we've seen in children.
So it's obvious if people have pre-existing conditions, and this truly makes it even more fatal for people that are critically ill or might have cancers or something. Tell us about why this there was an issue with ventilators and the ventilation strategies, and how does this impact patients that are already in the hospital that may contract this? They're at much more risk further than a pre-existing condition walking around on the streets, right?
Of course. So, I mean, patients who are in the hospital because of non-COVID issues, for example, having a heart attack or having brain surgery or having a stroke, all those patients would be at higher risk for contracting COVID. And then, of course, because their body was already impacted and so they were less resilient, they would manifest much more severe. So when they got infected, it would happen much quicker, and the manifestations of the infection would lead to organ failure. One of the biggest problems with the organ failure was the respiratory system, or the lungs, in where the lungs were unable to oxygenate properly and enough to deliver oxygen to the brain of patients. And so they required to be ventilated on, these are machines that essentially pump, compress oxygen into the body, and they allow the lungs to recuperate as the body is not being impaired by the oxygen limitations of the lungs. And so these ventilators, there's a certain number that we were using before COVID, and over dozens of years, we've learned how many ventilators, say a typical, say, 300-bed hospital might need 15 ventilators. But on the early waves in COVID in New York and Philadelphia and Detroit, that hospital might need 50 or 60 ventilators because that would be the number of people that were requiring respiratory support. And so in the early days, when there weren't enough ventilators to be had, this became a serious problem around how best to support these people. And today that's less of an issue because we've learned to adjust to the surge, but early on this became so serious that we were actually hardwiring, kind of hacking into the ventilator software to allow them to ventilate 2 patients with 1 machine. And there's a lot of problems with this model, but there were some modifications that allowed that. But the reality is that these machines are very complex hardware and software devices. They take a while to manufacture, or weeks to months. And so initially, this was a serious problem. It's not a problem anymore in the U.S. because we've been able to both manufacture more ventilators. So multiple factories have converted their production lines into making ventilators, and I think we've learned to get them to the right places. As you know, across the U.S., some areas have been hit much harder than others, and so that meant moving, for example, ventilators and other essential equipment from, say, places in the rural parts of the U.S. that did not have as many ventilatory requirements, moving them to urban settings where there was a much higher density of people being ill, and therefore many more people needing ventilation.
So this seems like it's going to change the way hospitals operate from now on. I mean, I think it's going to leave a remaining effect, which brings me to, if a hospital is the place you're going anyway because you're ill, how can a hospital even devise strategies to attempt to try to protect the caregivers? What do you think needs to happen?
That's a really important question. There's a lot of partial solutions being thrown out about opening the economy, and while many of them mean well, they're not really addressing some of the deeper challenges that hospitals, I think, are now finally getting around to them, and that is that there's clearly a few key indicators that we have to be focusing on in order to open non-essential businesses safely. And that means, of course, that rates of new cases need to be low and falling. That means that hospitals are able to treat all coronavirus patients in need. And that means there's a need to have the capacity to test everybody with symptoms. But then what? What are the evidence-driven rules for reentry? And is there any place that's figured it out? And sadly, as we've been hearing from airlines, we've been hearing from car companies, we've been hearing from Walmart, they've struggled to actually make their workplaces safe. And that has both caused employees to be sick as well as consumers to be afraid to come. So I think that we can learn a lot from healthcare. And I want to share with you some examples of what healthcare is doing differently, because I think they might be perhaps a roadmap for non-healthcare industry. And so number one, that means that as we're all on a learning curve, we have to be very good at collecting intelligence. And that means talking to people and finding out if they're healthy or not. And that means on a daily basis, surveying people. So for example, when I go into the hospital, before I go in every day, I'm surveyed. Do I have symptoms? Have I been around people with symptoms? Are there any new phenomena? And then the hospital sends me this code, which I then bring to the hospital on my phone, and that's read by an LED indicator at the entrance. And unless it's green, the hospital doesn't allow me in. So by doing so, they're doing several things. Number one, they're protecting the patients from me infecting them. We've known that in nursing homes, there's abundance of data that some of the people in nursing homes were infected by healthcare workers that came to take care of them. So that's number one. Number two, that if in fact I did have evidence of early infection, a fever or other evidence, then I would stay home and I would self-quarantine until I got better. And they would check in with me on a daily basis using a mobile app that would help me triage my own symptoms. Number two, that I'd be able to protect other healthcare workers from getting infected. In the U.S., over 25,000 healthcare workers have been infected from taking care of COVID patients. And so clearly this is a serious problem. And so we have to have a mechanism to make sure that healthcare workers aren't infected coming to work, and those that are infected are taken care of.
Well, think about protection is they think about this PPE stuff, you know, the personal protective equipment. But I hear you saying digital strategies is part of that. Well, can you touch on the stuff? I think now we're realizing we can't source it out to other countries. And then please go on. Number three is, you know, it sounds like there could be a digital way to manage this as well.
Absolutely. So I was going to talk number three about PPE. And so I think what we're talking about is a hybrid solution that includes both a digital before, during, and after solution. I'll talk about that in a moment, coupled with appropriate PPE. And so what does that look like? So for example, that means at home every day, I monitor myself and I convey that information to my employers. That also means that I can't go to work unless I've conveyed to my employers that I'm safe. And then they tell me that I'm able to come to work, and they convey to other workers that I'm safe. Number three, it means that if I have been infected, I'll stay home, but that doesn't mean I can't do some work remotely. It doesn't mean I'll lose my benefits. It doesn't mean I'll lose my salary. That's a really important thing. You know, there was a story last week, which I'm sure you read about, Hutton, in Missouri, where a hair salon worker was able to expose and perhaps infect as many as 91 people because she had been infected for at least 8 days, but didn't tell anybody and kept it very quiet because she was afraid of losing her job and losing her insurance benefits. And I think it's a really important point in the story, and that is if we want employees to speak up and be vulnerable and truthful, we have to make sure we don't punish them if they get infected, and that would mean losing their job or not being able to take care of their families and not being able to take care of their children. And so you have to be very careful about this issue, that this is going to require employees to feel safe to tell the truth to their employers so that there's a virtuous cycle of trust building. Now, the other aspect of it is the personal protective equipment. Initially, there wasn't enough. It's important to know that not all situations require a hazmat suit. So, for example, if you're an entry person, you know, somebody at the entrance to a hospital or a clinic, you do not need to wear a hazmat suit. It's enough that you wear a face shield, a mask, and gloves. However, if you're actually taking care of patients on wards, then you need a higher escalation. And if you're doing what we call aerosol-inducing procedures, for example, if you're doing open surgery, if you're intubating patients, and so we need to make sure that we allocate the equipment to the proper risk. And that applies equally outside of hospitals. So, for example, if you work as a cashier at Walmart, then you're going to need a plastic shield to keep you from the coughing and sneezing of people, and you're going to need gloves, and you're going to need an N95 mask because you're exposed to many, many people, even though each one for a short amount of time, but adapting the amount of PPE to the right scenario. And that way, we get more nimble at both protecting the workers as well as not running through all of our supplies. Because you can imagine, if we're not careful about the amount of PPE, you know, a staff to 8 hours could run through hundreds of gloves per shift. And that, of course, is not sustainable. So we have to get better understanding how much is enough and yet allow the system to not, if you will, overdo it. And I think we've learned that we've overshot a little bit early on in some ways, and in other ways, we've not been adequate in protecting cashiers, in protecting workers, essential workers. We have to find a better way to communicate that to the employees.
So, Dr. Paul, talking about communication, I realize that there's been tremendous complaints in system government, even with China, for not being transparent. And I know you are a big proponent, not only of making sure this is carefully messaged, but I heard your quote of being radically transparent when it comes to data. How will that help us in these uncertain times?
Well, I think that what pandemics have taught us is that top-down solutions, unfortunately, don't work. And what I mean by that is, unless the public trusts that when they go outside, they're going to be safe, they won't send their kids to school, they won't go shopping, they won't go on vacations, and they won't fly. And so we're now into, you know, 2.5 months of modified or complete shelters in place, and people are realizing in multiple surveys around the country that the majority of people don't trust the present solutions being offered to them. And so even though aviation has been open now for at least 4 to 5 weeks, they're still only at about 5 to 8%. Restaurants have been open in multiple states, and perhaps there's only 10 to 15% occupancy. And so I think until the public sees in a more transparent way, here are the risks, here are solutions, here's what it means, unless we trust them to use that data, and that means active reporting, that means active feedback on what happens to people that get infected, it means active messaging as far as what are the risks of going out to work, what are the risks of having children in open schools. Without that type of transparency, I'm afraid that people are going to be very fearful. I think they're going to allow all kind of conspiracies to fly, just like it happened in previous pandemics. You know, you might remember during the early days, Hutton, of the AIDS epidemic, that people thought that if you touch a patient with AIDS, you'll get AIDS.
Mm-hmm.
And it took Princess Diana to actually hug an AIDS patient to break that taboo. There was no risk from touching patients with AIDS. So we have to understand that there are things that are very safe to do in spite of COVID, and yet there are other things that are dangerous. And we have to be more clear and more transparent about what are those risks so that people can start feeling more comfortable and saying, I feel comfortable doing that. Therefore, I will take my kids to school. I will go to the market. I will fly to a trip. I will take a train. All these things require what we call a co-designed risk model. What that means is that the consumer is going to have to be better at managing risk, and they will only be able to do that if we educate them. And the education begins by being transparent. It continues by being truthful about the risk. It continues by showing vulnerability when we don't know. And finally, it ends with a sense that they know that we're telling the truth, because it's clear that some of the messaging coming out of Washington early on, that there were enough tests for everybody, that it was safe to do this, that, the other, that it was safe to go out, it's clear that that is not correct. And many people got infected because they were confused. And I'd like to make sure that as we reopen and continue to open, that we do so in a way that people feel comfortable and assured, not panic, but they feel prudently assured that it's okay to start going back to some of what they did before, but it might require redesigning their workplaces. It might require changing the way they eat at restaurants. It might require a different way for going to the DMV, et cetera, et cetera.
What we're talking about is messaging and transparency. It's a good point. We're going to take a break real quick. When we come back, we're going to be talking about how can the gap be bridged? How can technology and things like telehealth be used to better manage from the outside? And how is COVID-19 good for research and innovation? What should hospitals do? And how to keep your hospital in the great communication gap with family employers? Because everybody is afraid of this COVID-19. We're going to get to more truthfulness and transparency right after this.
Do you know why Joe Vaughn loves doing talk radio? Because he has a face made for radio. It's true. Look at his website. He's a nerd hiding out in a biker's body. Speaking of body, how about a quick pee-pee break? Joe Vaughn will be right back.